everyone. Sorry to interrupt your lunch. Continue on. I'm just going to introduce our speaker. I'm Nan Heehan, Board of Governor at the club. I'm also a member of the Professionals Committee. Can I just ask everyone to turn off any of your mobile phones or devices or switch them on to silent? Thank you. So, drugs, triads, terrorism, prostitution, illegal gambling, money laundering. This is going to be a great lunch. Now, how do the authorities in the mainland, Taiwan, Hong Kong, combat these organized criminal activities? For 10 years, Professor Low has researched these themes to compile his latest book, The Politics of Controlling Organized Crime in Greater China. Today, he's going to share those insights, and boy, are there interesting insights about how these criminal organizations operate and conduct these activities across the border, and the level of police cooperation to combat these crimes in different legal jurisdictions, but also the implications, including the political implications of such collaboration. Sunny Low is a professor of the Department of Social Sciences at the Hong Kong Institute of Education. He's an expert on local and regional politics as well as cross-border crime, and he has written several books on these subjects, including Hong Kong's Indigenous Democracy, which was published last year, The Politics of Earthquake Management in China, which was published in 2014. Everyone, please give a warm welcome to Professor Low.
Thank you, Chair Lady. It is my great honor to present my findings to all the guests here today. I try to use this new book to focus on the People's Republic of China, the Republic of China and Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Macau, to highlight, number one, the ways in which the Chinese state, Taiwan state, and the city-states of Hong Kong and Macau have been dealing with organized crime. And most importantly, whether they have the capacity, autonomy, and legitimacy in crime control. And the major argument, as you can see from this slide, for those who want to have my PowerPoint, you are very welcome to email me, and I will send the PowerPoint to you right away. Now, the major argument is that the capacity of the mainland Chinese and Taiwan states, and also that of the Hong Kong and Macau city states, have been enhanced through, number one, regional and international police cooperation, and secondly, the joint anti-crime campaigns. The book is quite heavy in terms of organization. Chapter 1, I focus on crime and state in Greater China. Chapter 2, focusing on triads in China, Hong Kong, and Macau. Chapter 3, the Heidao in Taiwan. Chapter 4, terrorism in China. Chapter 5, the politics of anti-prostitution. Chapter 6, underground casinos in mainland China. Macau has formal casinos, and Hong Kong has casino cruise ships. Chapter 7, anti-narcotics, and finally, I focus on mainland China and Taiwan cooperation as well as international cooperation. For those familiar with China, you know that actually China before the market reform actually had lots of institutions relatively insulated from organized crime. But the situation has been changing very rapidly since liberalization and marketization in the middle of 1970s. We have seen lots of criminal groups emerging. The problem of China is that there is a central state in Beijing, and this central state has to cope with the relatively weak local states in provinces and cities. And so you can see President Xi Jinping, especially after the formation of the National Security Commission in November 2013, he has to enhance the capacity of Beijing by using what I call anti-crime policy wins. Throughout 2014, anti-crime campaigns were very prominent, ranging from anti-drugs to anti-prostitution to anti-trials to anti-terrorism. So I think the setting up of the National Security Commission in late 2013 was really a turning point. Now, in the case of Hong Kong and Macau, the colonial state actually in both places in the past were affected by crime. But the birth of the ICAC in Hong Kong in 1974 represented a clean break with the past. And now we see a post-colonial state in Hong Kong relatively autonomous from organized crime groups, thanks to the ICAC effort and also thanks to the clean government here. Macau has improved significantly. In the past, we saw police corruption, but since 1999, the situation has improved. Although just last week we saw reports concerning police corruption. Having said that, actually the Macau state has enhanced its capacity to deal with crime. With regard to China, trials have been quite prominent, even though the criminal law in China is quite harsh to deal with all these organized crime groups. I give you an example here in this PowerPoint. In February 2015, a mainland tribe boss named Liu Han was executed. He was a rich businessman in Sichuan, and he cultivated relations with Zhao Bin, the son of the former Politburo member Zhao Yongkang. And these trials had 36 members operating for 10 years, and the boss' younger brother, Liu Wei, went to gamble in Macau, Singapore, Australia, America, losing Singapore dollars, 11 million in Singapore, and US, 11 million in the US. And in Macau, Liu Wei lost to Hong Kong, 100 million. And he even opened companies in Hong Kong, organizing the mainland tourists to gamble in Macau. And some of the companies acted as junkets in Macau's casinos and earned Hong Kong $2.3 billion. All these things are actually reported in the press. And so you can see these all these activities. Trials in Macau actually adopt a relatively low profile, especially shortly before December 20th, 1999, because they have to give the overlord China mianzi or face. And the trials in Macau, they know how to operate under the political economy of casino capitalism, because they have to operate very carefully inside and outside casinos. They offer so-called one dragon service and notably loan sharking. In Hong Kong, trials also adopt a low profile, but here in Hong Kong, the trials exist because of the adaptability to profit opportunities, the incessant supply of young blood, the relatively light penalties, and also a hidden criminal procurement nexus entrenched at some district and village levels. With regard to cross-border police cooperation, it is a necessary condition for the governments of China, Hong Kong, and Macau to fight against trials. Basically, they do very well in terms of sharing intelligence, conducting joint anti-crime campaigns, and also, most importantly, transferring criminal suspects. Although there's no rendition agreement between mainland and Hong Kong, the common practice here is for the mainland authorities to hand over criminal suspects to Hong Kong side administratively at the border checkpoints. And even if the crimes are not conducted in mainland China, but if the Chinese authorities see such criminal activities as being planned in the mainland, the criminal suspect can be handled by the mainland court rather than sending them to Hong Kong, as we can see from the Big Spender case, who was trialed and executed in China in 1998. The Taiwan state is a little bit more problematic, although Taiwan is a Western-style democracy. The Taiwan state remains relatively weak vis-a-vis organized crime, because the organized crime groups and elements have penetrated into the institutions through electoral participation, money politics, and bureaucratic corruption. You can see that in the recent presidential election, the gambling activities concerning electoral results was also quite prominent. But fortunately, the defenders of the Taiwan clean government include most prosecutors, court judges, media professionals, and social activists who scrutinize the government from time to time. And there is now a new anti-corruption body. But whether this anti-corruption body can work successfully, it remains to be seen. With regard to anti-terrorism in China, I have to alert you to the Kunming 2014 train station attack by the terrorists, leading to the death of 31 people and 141 injuries. The mainland police killed 5 terrorists and arrested 4 others. What was interesting was that the 8 terrorists originally they tried to sneak out from the Yunnan province to Vietnam, but security was so tight that they have to go back to Guangdong. So at one time we saw that the Macau border was very tight full of public security police, mainly because of such incident. And eventually they returned to launch a jihad at the Kunming train station. And some of them operated in Guangzhou, Zhuhai, and also Gansu. They nominate their leader, training themselves, buying weapons, and also they learn the methods of making bombs and use foreign-made videos to propagate religious extremist activities. Now, here, I think Hong Kong, Taiwan, Macau, anti-terrorism does not constitute a serious threat, although some security consultancy recently said that Macau casinos may become a possible target of terrorism. Now, what is interesting about anti-terrorism in China is that it is characterized by extensive mobilization of the police, military, and ordinary citizens. Mass mobilization remains very important for the Chinese state to deal with terrorism, because after the terrorist attack in Kunming, all the mainland cities mobilized citizens as vigilante, guarding their cities, acting as the informants of the states, and this was very prominent. Anti-prostitution policy wind occurred in early 2014 when a reporter from the central television, CCTV, went to Dongun, you know, as a sort of undercover agent and exposed the seriousness of prostitution in the city. Now, this interesting event showed that actually the CCTV reporter, he was not really a reporter. He actually was a former police officer. So it seems that actually the central government in Beijing fully supported his activities to disclose the prostitution in Dongun, and then eventually a wave of anti-prostitution occurred throughout China in the entire year. Now, what was interesting in this case is that the Guangdong Party Secretary, Wu Chunhua, right, ordered 6,000 police to crack down on the prostitution once he watched the central TV report. And there were reports saying that actually there were some political enemies targeting this party secretary. But whatever the situation, the problem of prostitution was controlled for some time. But recent reports, I think in the last 2 weeks, have shown that prostitution in Dongun is adapting to the situation very quickly. And the prostitution industry is using e-technology, you know, to spread out the business and to adapt to the situation in a very skillful way. But in this Dongun crackdown, the deputy mayor was dismissed because he was regarded as failing to do a good job. Now, what is interesting about the Dongun crackdown is that Beijing, as the central government, had to rely on anti-prostitution campaign to rein in those provinces and cities which ignore the center's policy directives. Another interesting phenomenon is that China has lots of underground casinos, as I went through all the news very carefully in the past 5 to 10 years. And actually, some of these casinos are operating just like Macau. Some of them even use Macau-style chips and operation. Macau has formal casinos. Now, Hong Kong has casino cruise ships. And here, for those who are not familiar with the Hong Kong casino cruise ships, we have to go back to 1988. And it was originated from a kind of 21-year-old cargo ship, which was later on turned into a so-called Oriental Princess. So from that time onwards, there have been more and more casino cruise ships. What is interesting about the casino cruise ships is that with the influx of the mainland individual tourists into Hong Kong, some of them could not easily find hotel accommodation. And instead, they saw casino cruises as the place where they could stay. In 2008, casino cruises attracted 480,000 mainland tourists, fivefold increase compared to the situation in 2006. In 2009, there were 8 casino cruises in Hong Kong. In 2013 alone, 1.3 million people went to gamble and play on casino cruise ships. 60% of them were from Hong Kong, 40% from the mainland, and many tourists actually came from women. In February 2014, 8 casino cruises operated in Hong Kong. So ladies and gentlemen, there's a nice division of labor, even in terms of casinos, between Hong Kong and Macau. With regard to anti-narcotics in Greater China, I think in the recent 5 years, ICE has become very prominent in, in all these four regions in Greater China. And another interesting characteristic is that more and more young people have been involved in drugs use and drugs trade. I don't have to mention the names. You may recall some actors, actresses who were caught in mainland China for drugs use and drug trafficking. Now, the interesting case here is the Lufeng City, because in Lufeng City in mainland China, the entire village engaged in drugs production, namely ice production, because the village was led by the Thai clan. You know, and this clan was so powerful that it continued to produce ice for Hong Kong, for Southeast Asia, for even overseas countries. And here in 2013, December, 3,000 Guangdong police went to smash 18 drug syndicates in the village. So you can see that the police had to be sent from the Guangdong provincial government to deal with the village. The implication is that the township, just one level up the village, failed to deal with the drug production. So you know, in China, you know, the study of organized crime and anti-narcotics have to take the levels of governments into consideration. So the provincial government failed to deal with Lufeng City, Boshe Village, and also their neighboring townships. So Beijing, as the central government, is really too far away from all these so-called independent local kingdoms. So you can see why Xi Jinping is so keen to deal with all these criminal activities in different places. Now, how about Taiwan? Well, Taiwan discussed whether the outlying islands like Panghu, Kinmen, and Matsu should have casinos. And in September 2009, Panghu held a referendum in which 42% of the voters cast their ballots. And most people actually opposed. And then in 2012, the people of Matsu supported the idea of building casinos on the island. 1,700 voters cast their ballots for it, whereas only 1,300 voted against the idea. Now, but what was interesting was the reaction from mainland officials. In May 2015, mainland official Zhang Jijun told the Taiwan business people from Kinmen that if casinos were open in Kinmen, the PRC would consider stopping the process of the free openings, namely aviation, maritime, and mail delivery. Now, this is very interesting. It means that the PRC side was deeply concerned about the possibility of increasing cross-border criminal activities between mainland and Kinmen. In other words, mainland officials may not like to see Kinmen to become another Macau, you know, attracting gamblers from the mainland. So here we will have to observe very carefully, especially in Taiwan, where there will be a new government very soon. With regard to mainland China and Taiwan police cooperation, I would say that they have been doing very well since the April 2009 joint anti-crime agreement. From time to time, they share intelligence. They also share evidence and enhance cooperation among the law enforcement agencies. The only challenge is the use of evidence in the courts, because it was reported that in Taiwan, the courts did not really regard the evidence collected in mainland as the evidence. So you know, they have to hammer out all these technical issues further. But basically, I think they have been working quite well. Cooperation with foreign countries. You may have noticed that extradition agreements have been signed between China and many other countries. And this is very important because China is keen to chase the corrupt officials, especially for those escaping overseas. The landmark event was the extradition of Lai Chang-sing, who stayed in Canada for a long period of time, as you all know, until July 2011, when he was sent back to PRC for trial on corruption charges. When Lai Chang-sing was in Canada, I was also working there, and he hired a very good human rights lawyers to argue for his case to stay in Canada until the time when the former premier, Zhu Rongji, went to Canada and discussed with the Canadian officials a kind of solution. International police cooperation here, we see that police cooperation is extremely important. Number one, they share intelligence. Number two, they have liaison officers. And number three, they have regular conferences and meetings and exchanges, and these are very important. And since the retrocession, both Macau and Hong Kong governments have considerable autonomy in cooperating with foreign nation states to combat cross-border crime. So here, the concept of autonomy is fully demonstrated in Hong Kong's and Macau's cooperation with foreign states in the fight against cross-border criminal activities. And this situation is supported by Beijing. Now, what is my conclusion? The conclusion, as I stated earlier, the state capacity, autonomy, legitimacy vary in all these four cases. In China, the central government in Beijing did and does have the political will to control organized crime, which is seen as a national security threat to the mainland Chinese government. The establishment of the National Security Commission, as I mentioned, in November 2013, was a turning point in all this anti-crime policy campaign under the current leadership of President Xi Jinping. So he is very keen to mop up everything in China. To PRC leaders, anti-crime campaigns can enhance regime legitimacy, rein in the excessive autonomy of local governments, consolidate the central government's legitimacy, and reduce criminal infiltration into the local states. So in short, localism remains the problem in China's crime control. The central government is relatively strong and has the political will to deal with organized crime, but some local states are punctuated by corrupt police office, corrupt police force, weak anti-graft work, and institutions infiltrated by criminal elements and organizations. So you can see a cycle of anti-corruption targeting at local officials. And there is a tug of war between the central government in Beijing and the local kingdoms. And this is a crucial factor shaping the success or failure of the combat against organized crime in China. So here, this is quite prominent. Now, how about Hong Kong and Macau? Well, Hong Kong and Macau, I think the city-states here have been maintaining their relatively strong capacity to control organized crime. No doubt about that. And Hong Kong government and Macau government, they have been conducting anti-crime, anti-trias campaigns from time to time, taking advantage of the intra-trias and inter-trias struggle, cracking down on their economic activities. Macau adopts a slightly different approach, trying to contain all these criminal activities within the casinos. And of course, in Macau, the police, they have to monitor and contain the trias very carefully. Taiwan is located somewhere between mainland China on the one hand and Hong Kong and Macau on the other. The influence of the Heidao in Taiwan cannot be underestimated because its members have already been penetrating some political institutions at various levels of government. To some extent, the Taiwan situation is perhaps similar to Italy, where the mafia there are pretty strong. Police cooperation has consolidated the capacity and legitimacy of the PRC state, Taiwan state, and the city states of Hong Kong and Macau to combat crime and cross-border crime. I think so. Thank you very much. That's my summary.
Okay, thank you, Sunny. Okay, I'm opening this up to the floor. Does anybody have any questions? Can you please identify yourself and the organization that you're with? Anyone has questions? At the back over there.
Hi, I'm Ben Bland from the Financial Times. Thanks for the talk. You obviously presented the Hong Kong, Taiwan and mainland governments as having a united front on dealing with triads and organized crime. But as you know, there's frequent allegations that given the Communist Party has no official status in Hong Kong, Macau and Taiwan, that various authorities use triad groups as front organizations to try and influence politics and business in Taiwan, Hong Kong and Macau. Obviously, some people think we've seen an example of that with the abduction of these booksellers. So how far do you think this is a problem, collusion between mainland police and triads and other organized crime groups outside the mainland to operate as proxies for the Communist Party? Thanks.
Okay, yeah, thank you for the question. I think mainland police have been undergoing modernization in the past 5 to 10 years. I have been chasing and reading all these mainland police journals in the past 10 years. Actually, I think they have been accelerating the process of changing the police operation like Hong Kong So to this extent, I think to be fair to the mainland police, they have been modernizing quite quickly. Of course, there may be a small minority of rotten apples who forge relationships with triers from Hong Kong and Macau, but I think these police officers are mostly in the local areas, especially Guangdong and Fujian, where Hong Kong and Macau criminal activities are pretty active. With regard to the book publisher's case, I think it's a separate one. This is more complicated because if you take a look at the publisher's books, I don't know how, I don't know whether the friends sitting here buy some of these books and read. I was one of the readers of these books. and actually, some of these books are highly explosive and sensitive in terms of the content. Because, as outside observers studying Chinese politics, we cannot verify the content of all these books. But I can tell you that many of these books had explosive contents, you know, targeting at top leaders, you know, their activities, you know, their private affairs, even the PLA, you know. To this extent, I'm not so sure whether some of these books might have antagonized some mainland people with Western interests. As I mentioned in this short summary, when we study Chinese politics, including crime control, the levels of governance in China is very complex. You have the central government in Beijing, you have the provincial government, you have the township government, you have the local government, you have the village government. So, you know, with so many levels of government, we have to find out several things with regard to this book publisher's incident. Number one, you know, which level of government might have sent someone to, quote unquote, invite them to go back to the motherland for investigation. This is the first thing. And secondly, you know, if you take a look at some of these books' back cover, some of these books' back cover had NT dollars, meaning that, you know, if you go to Taiwan, you can buy all these books easily. And there are lots of questions being raised here. Number one, you know, who subsidized the publications of these books? Who were the writers leaking out all this information? Were some of the information totally fake, or were some of them actually correct to the extent that it really prompted mainland investigation? I don't think this publisher's case is linked to police corruption. I think the publisher case is linked to a whole range of complex issues beyond our understanding. But in short, I think Hong Kong triers and also Macau triers, they are under the cooptation, or if you like, as you mentioned earlier, united front work of the mainland authorities. Recently, I read a Macau news report saying that former Macau underworld leader went into mainland China, and even he was greeted by the mainland United Front official, and they took a picture in the newspaper. Very interesting. So you are right. You know, they conducted United Front work targeting at Hong Kong and Macau Heidao. Taiwan Heidao is more difficult. Taiwan Heidao, they are very active in Southeast Asia, notably Thailand, you know, Southeast Asia. Whether they are the target of mainland United Front, well, it's difficult to say, but we don't have the evidence to prove that. So, in short, I think the publisher's case has to be separated from mainland police corruption. And if mainland corrupt police occur, mainly they occur in the coastal areas. Yeah.
And next question. Professor, you know, we see the Xi Jinping and the anti-corruption drive, tigers and fleas alike. A lot of China watchers see this as a consolidation of political power. For those who are unfamiliar, can you explain more deeply if this is truly a consolidation of political power, or is it so pervasive of crime, organized crime, at so many political levels that he is purging both?
Yeah, this is a good question. I think when Xi Jinping came to power, when he became the General Secretary in 2012, he realized the extent of problems in China with lots of Western interests here and there. So with the setting of the NSC, National Security Commission, in 2013, we saw a very obvious campaign, quite different from the Hu Jintao era. It is something more than anti-corruption. It is something, I would say, a purge of all those leaders as subordinates or even relatives linked to organized crime and bureaucratic and even private sector corruption. But the resistance is there. Maybe because of such resistance, we saw all these sensitive books published in Hong Kong, because we never know whether some of the news leak out to the books are actually from some factional leaders resistant to anti-corruption. So I think you are right. I think the situation is far more complex. The major problem is that when we study Chinese politics, it is like palace politics, palace. We may recall the late Professor Lucien Pai from MIT. He wrote a very famous book, The Spirit of Chinese Politics. He said that Chinese politics are just like palace politics in the old dynasties, with lots of secrecy and Guanxi politics. That's the problem. So to answer your question, definitely it is something more than anti-corruption. It is about a real purge of all those linked to corruption and also organized crime. And remember, even the PLA was affected. The PLA had to undergo a drastic reform, including a change of military regions, change of military leaders. And it was reported that, as some of you may know, the military general who helped Xi Jinping in the anti-corruption campaign in within the PLA, he himself has to go because of possible resistance within the PLA. So it is deep-rooted corruption, and it is not easy for him to deal with this issue, and it takes time for us to observe for how long this anti-corruption will sustain itself.
Any more questions? Oh, at the back, and then we'll go to Bill.
I'm Joe Simone with an intellectual property protection company called SIPS. Counterfeiting is, I've been doing this from Hong Kong since the 80s, and it's been growing and growing. It's probably worse than ever with the internet, pumping demand and making it easy for factories to sell direct to consumers, et cetera. And companies don't want to talk about this, people have kind of gotten tired of the story in the press, so it doesn't really get the attention it needs on so many levels. But I'm just curious if it's big. I know it's big. We all know it's big. Has this, and organized crime, we've seen pieces of that, in our work day to day. But, it's always considered generally to be in bulk a small operators, opportunist approach. And, with some political support, if you will, in some ways. But I guess my question is really, have you, in your research, found much evidence of, more organization behind this business, triads, et cetera?
And
you can say just read the book if you want.
Yes. Actually, intellectual property rights issue was very prominent around 2005 to 2008, because at that time I was researching on my first book on cross-border crime. At that time, China did pay attention to this issue because the Americans did bring up this issue to the Chinese authorities. So at that time, Chinese police took it quite seriously. But then later on, when I read through all these news and documents, as time passes, it seems that the policy priorities of crime control change from intellectual property rights to all these organized crime, terrorism now very high priority. So to answer a question, I think this explains the shifting areas of priorities under the Chinese policing agenda. You may also have noticed that in the recent months, I don't know how many of you read the Chinese news reports, in the recent months, suddenly, all these anti-money laundering reports came up. In the past several years, it was very difficult for me to get anti-money laundering reports. So you can see that actually now they are targeting at the commercial stock market, commercial activities, commercial organizations, business organizations, stock market securities. So to answer your question, I think it illustrates the changing priorities of crime control agenda in China. It is now, I think, is lower priority. Whether they are really controlled by triads, I would say definitely controlled by criminal gangsters, but not necessarily triads, because when we use the term triads, we often think about hierarchical organizations with the dragon head at the top, with all the soldiers and also think tank in the middle and the lower level. Chinese organized crime is more fluid in the sense that they use their clanship, they use their Guanxi to network with each other. So it is very difficult for the Chinese police to control all these criminal activities, including intellectual properties, property rights. And recently, you may also have noticed that in the mainland Chinese media, a lot of efforts have been paid on dealing with art crime, the robbery of cemeteries, all these cemeteries with the treasures from the kings, emperors. But having said that, the police do not have sufficient manpower. So you also see that the mainland police are now undergoing tremendous modernization. They have set up the auxiliary police along the style of Hong Kong police. But not all the auxiliary police exist everywhere. So you can see that the manpower has a problem in mainland in terms of policing.
Thank you. I've enjoyed your presentation, Professor. Different countries give different definition for conspiracy laws, which thus affects organized crime. Do they have the same legal definition for organized crime in China as it is in Macau and Hong Kong? And if not, how does that impact things? And just one more follow-up question after that. Falun Gong, China refers to them as organized crime. Do they fit the definition of organized crime in China?
Yeah. I think the Chinese law on organized crime is pretty broad, very different from the common law definition in Hong Kong. And even though Macau has a legal system, continental legal system similar to China, the mainland Chinese definition of organized crime is a sort of organization, engaging in illegal activities, very broad. With regard to Falun Gong, they don't really regard Falun Gong as a kind of, criminal organization. Instead, they regard the Falun Gong as a kind of a political organization, from what I read, And to answer a question, the mainland laws are pretty loose, in terms of the definition, pretty loose. Hong Kong law is pretty clear, but I would say compared to the U.S., the law on punishing the gangsters is much stricter in the U.S. Than Hong Kong. So you see, there seems to be some legal differences here. For Falun Gong, it is highly political because their activities exist in Hong Kong, in overseas countries like U.K., Canada, Australia, America. And China regards all these Falun Gong activities as probably backed up by quote-unquote foreigners or even other states. So to answer a question, it seems to me that the mainland Chinese police regard Falun Gong as more a political organization.
Thank you, Professor. James Bibiezer from Haymarket. I'd say the consensus within the financial community, which is what I deal with, regarding the anti-corruption campaign is that this is Xi Jinping's way to assert his power, shape things the way he wants to shape, and then he would have the freedom to enact the difficult reforms such as state enterprise restructuring. Is that frequency true, in your opinion? Do we need to wait for these political and criminal campaigns to achieve a certain level of effect before Xi Jinping or his ministers can really pay more attention to other things such as business and financial reform? Is that true? And is there a point at which, as many people in the financial industry are waiting for, perhaps foolishly, is there a point at which he will then, say, declare victory in his anti-corruption campaigns and move on from that? Thank you.
Thank you for your question. I think the mainland leadership mentality is slightly different from what you said. I think the mainland leadership believes that reforms are undergoing in all fronts, including financial sector, commercial sector. For the state-owned enterprises, the guests sitting here may have noticed that the higher executives of the state-owned enterprises have their salaries slashed by the central authority quite significantly in recent months. So, you know, actually, Wang Qishan, the anti-corruption chief in China, is very keen to clean up all fronts. But of course, there is resistance. So, I would say the mainland official reaction to your insight is that they would disagree with you. They would say that we are trying to do everything. But of course, the financial sector, you know, the extent to which financial reforms should be undertaken remains controversial. You know, we of course, we hope that some areas should be reformed in a more significant and deeper way. But having said that, I think Xi Jinping's policy is really to deepen anti-corruption first. And he is trying to inculcate a kind of a clean governance psyche among the leaders of the state-owned enterprises. I don't know how many guests are here. Know that actually the Central Committee Politburo, the Politburo Standing Committee, the seven most powerful leaders in China, in the past 3 years, they talk about using the Hong Kong model of anti-corruption at least twice, according to Hong Kong-based Chinese magazines. They discussed at least twice whether amnesty should be granted to those corrupt officials at a particular year, just like the Hong Kong situation where we set up the ICAC and then Governor Magdalhoost used 1974 as the turning point. That is to say, corrupt officials before 1974, we forget about it. They did debate this issue, and twice the standing committee members, the seven members, voted on this proposal, and twice this proposal was defeated. So, you know, within the, if this report was accurate, we did really see serious discussion within the Beijing leadership on how to tackle corruption. And in a sense, you are right, because your insight mentions that, well, they have to deepen anti-corruption campaign first and then, you know, clear up the financial sector. And now that there is resistance even within the standing committee, and you may also have heard that actually the former leader Hu Jintao, you know, criticized himself in one of the elderly discussion meetings, and reportedly he had a stroke. You know, so you could see that actually the top Chinese leadership had serious and fierce debate, but I think there is no way out because the resistance seems to be hidden here and there. So it takes time for them to really entrench a kind of clean governance culture.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for. Everyone, let's give a thank you to Professor Sunny Lo.
Thank you.